So the central practices of mindfulness is to really be present for what is. But some of you maybe, when you signed up for this retreat, didn't sign up for this kind of what is, of what happened today. And it's not uncommon the first day that people have, what did I sign up for? And I maybe said this too often, but I'm very fond of the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where Calvin is and Hobbes are climbing out on a branch, climbing a tree like kids do maybe. And Calvin so happily says, oh, it's so great just to be in the present moment. Everyone should do this. We're just really enjoying being here for the experience. And Hobbes says, yes, but you're supposed to be in school right now. So we're here, and I can well imagine that some of you is challenging today for many ways. How many of you today were surprisingly sleepy? It's a lot of you. How many of you had headaches? A few of you had headaches. How many of you, your body hurt more than you expected? How many of you were discouraged today? A few of you. So, and how many of you found it difficult today? That's fewer than all the other hands. Some of you raised your hands every time, looks like. So it's very common, and that the first day is challenging. And I hope that those of you who found it challenging one way or other, saw the other hands go up, that you realize you're not alone with this. And that's part of what we're trying to do, is learning to be with what is, even if it's difficult, even if it's challenging. But in being with what is, we do it in order to find our freedom in it and to find our love in what's going on, how to hold ourselves with care and compassion, and how to hold ourselves without getting caught up in or entangled with what is. And that's whether sometimes it's going really well, sometimes it's going difficult. In both the situations, learning to find the freedom and the care, the ease with the situation is a very important part of the practice. So the training began today, and it'll continue as we go along. Some of the experiences of the first day will diminish over the next days and recede from memory, and other things will arise. And the task is to meet what's arising. The theme that we set up for this, for the talks, for this retreat, is a bringing together two important practices and aspects of Buddhism, and somehow having them reflect each other for the retreat. And one of them is the Four Noble Truths. And the other is what's called the Four Brahmaviharas, the four attitudes of love that are championed in Buddhism as the primary social virtues, primary way in which to approach others and oneself in this world. And to hold these together, to see them as supporting each other, I think is a very good thing to see. In some sense, the Four Noble Truths has a lot to do with having the willingness to see your life as it actually is, very directly, the actuality of our life. And unfortunately, maybe more often than not, for many people, the actuality of their life has a fair amount of suffering in it, challenges. The Brahmaviharas, things like loving-kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, certainly they're part of life as well, but chances are that for most people that it's a smaller part of their life than the suffering part. And sometimes we hold up these things like compassion and loving-kindness as wonderful ideals, and there's a big gap between what's actual and what the ideal is. And I like to think of these, that what we want to do is to bring these together and have them work together. The actual should be together with the ideal, or bring them together so they're not separate, so they become one, so that whatever is the ideal becomes what's actual. And what's actual becomes, in some ways, ideal. The word for the noble truths, four noble truths, is the word noble. And it's meant to be, I think, a very dignified idea that there is noble suffering. There's noble cause of suffering. There's a noble cessation of it, the noble eightfold way. And this idea of that there's something ideal, something very powerful, something very inspiring about these four noble truths. So the actual, the ideal, they come together in some ways. Sometimes love is the actual, and sometimes maybe the four noble truths, the nobility of these four truths, are the ideal that we're trying to discover. And I think of them as coming together in this wonderful way that we bring our hands together when we bow. This namaste, kind of when the palms come together in front of our chest. We have two different hands, they're apart, they do different things, and occasionally they come together, and they come together kind of to become one. And you can't have these two things become one if you just have one hand. You bring them together both like this. And in order to do this, you don't hold your hand in a fist. That makes it very different. I don't know if you'd feel the same way if you went around like this. And you have to open your hand so the soft part of the hands can come and meet. If you have your hand in a fist, fists have particular usefulness, but not very many. And you can't do much with a fist. Most of the things we can think of maybe are not such a helpful for other people, going around with a fist, But sometimes you use your fist kind of to knock the door. Let me in. I'm here. So sometimes when we're all bound up and tight and constricted, we can cause a lot of suffering in the world, get angry and resentful and to ourselves and others. Or we can take our own challenges, the way we're tightened up in a fist, mental fist, and see it actually as kind of something's knocking on your door, saying, here. Here's something for you to pay attention to. Here's something to open to. But, those two things, a violent fist or a knocking hand, is not that big of a range. You have these wonderful things of a hand that become much more useful when we're able to open them up. When we can open up the ways we're contracted in our hearts, contracted in our minds and hearts become much more useful. We can meet other people. When you have your hand open, you can, touching another person on the shoulder or shaking hands or something, kind of feels good for them. It's kind of nice. It's kind of a very human, heartfelt connections can be made. It's harder to do that with a fist, even if you're gentle and come up slowly. I guess sometimes we do kind of at least what's it called when they fist bump. So I guess that's good too. It's the third thing you can do with a fist. But to be able to open up and then bring these parts of ourselves that together, and I think one of the things to bring the world of our suffering and have it exist together with are the world of our love, our capacity for caring, our capacity to feel connectedness with others and the world around us. Sometimes with suffering, when we have kind of deep in our own difficulties, it can also often be very isolating. We feel very alone, it's just us. It's hard to reach out sometimes. My default approach to suffering is the ostrich approach. I just kind of bury my head in the sand when I suffer. Maybe other people attack. But all kinds of common approaches, but they're kind of isolating either way. But the Brahmaviharas are the connecting emotions. I think they're primarily involved with how we connect to others, but they can also be towards ourselves. So the way that we thought of making this connection for the retreat is that to connect the first noble truth, which is a noble truth of suffering, with metta, loving kindness. And the second noble truth of the cause of suffering with compassion. And the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, with upekkha, which is equanimity. And the fourth noble truth, the noble eightfold path that leads to the cessation of suffering, with mudita, with joy. And it would be nice if by the end we get to the eightfold path part that you feel the joy or the delight or the deep appreciation of having a path of practice to walk. It's a great thing to be able to practice, to have a path that's so meaningful and so powerful and so effective and such a wonderful gift to others that you walk it. And so hopefully have some sense of the joy of that. So the Four Noble Truths, I remember many years ago, when I was in my 20s and just beginning my Buddhist practice, I went to dinner with an old girlfriend. Couldn't have been that old since I was pretty young. And but I went to, and she asked me, "What are you up to?" And I said, "You know, I was doing this Buddhist practice." And she said, "What's that about? What's Buddhism about?" So I told her about the Four Noble Truths. And as I was leaving, when I left, I was walking through San Francisco to go home, I thought, boy, that was kind of like pretty simplistic. That was pretty, you know, kind of like kindergarten Buddhism. You know, not very sophisticated. And, you know, I didn't think then I should try to get a PhD in Buddhism or something to make up for it at that time. But you know, but as I've kind of practiced Buddhism and studied it over the years, I really appreciate how much these Four Noble Truths, the way they're formulated and the way that we understand them, really encompass something life-changing and very profound. And as simple as they are to explain, maybe they can maybe take a lifetime to really actualize and really sink deep into them and really really have them transform us in a powerful way. And I find it remarkable that, you know, that the essence or this the heart of this Buddhist practice can be encapsulated in these four statements. And part of it is that they are ordinary statements of that is kind of accessible to most people, at least logically, without recourse to a lot of theology, complicated beliefs about supernatural lives or parts of metaphysical lives or mystical lives or things that are beyond what we can see. It's something that's pretty empirical, indirect. That's the idea, supposed to be able to see it and experience it directly for ourselves. And that this is held to be at the center of this whole religious tradition, I find kind of very refreshing, very delightful. There was in time of the Buddha a man who was going around slandering the Buddha. And he said, this Buddha guy, he has no special powers. And all he teaches is the end of suffering. That's it. And well, I don't know. I know that I'd rather end suffering than have special powers. And I think it's pretty amazing. It's kind of to have this medicine.
Special powers.
Special powers. Special powers. Yeah, a little bit brighter. Great, thank you. So So I find it remarkable to have this kind of almost naturalness of, you know, seeing something directly. And it's not, you know, it's not a difficult thing. It's like if you put your hand on a hot stove, or let's say you put your hand in a fire, and it starts hurting because your hand's in the burning in the fire. You know, you don't look around. Who else can you blame for this? And you don't look around and say, you know, someone else should really fix this problem. You know, that doesn't get you very far. And, you know, maybe someone else is responsible that your hand's in there because they told you to put it in. So you're going to keep them, you know, keep your hand in there until they take responsibility. That's kind of silly, right? Because, you know, your hand's in there and it's your job to pull it out. And you want to pull it out as quickly as you can. So it's pretty straightforward, you know, if you're in the fire, you pull your hand out. So there's that's true also psychologically, is that if you put your heart in the fire of craving or of hate, that there might be all kinds of conditions around you that stimulated and brought about the craving, the hate, the fear that you might have. The Four Noble Truths are saying, don't spend a lot of time being blinded or being fixated on the conditions in the world around you. Even if someone else told you to hate or caused the conditions for you to hate or be angry, don't wait for them to change. If your hand's in the fire, maybe you can pull it out. If your hand's in the fire of hate, you're hating, you don't have to stay there. It's possible to take it out. If you're caught up in the fire of greed, you don't keep it there. You can take it out. And in Buddhism, they also say the fire of ignorance. So you can get caught in that and you pull that out. Or the fire of conceit. You get burned with your conceit. And so you pull. Can you pull that out? And when you sit and are quiet, and if you're mindful, one of the great gifts of that is, and maybe curses for some of us, is you get to feel the fire. You get to feel what it's like. But the advantage of seeing really feeling the suffering of your anger, the suffering of hate, the suffering of clinging, the suffering of conceit, is that then you can begin finding how you can pull your hand out. What you can let go of, how to quench those fires. But if you don't feel the fire, then the very basic human instinct to want to pull the hand out, to want to alleviate that suffering, is not going to operate very well, you know, because, you know, if you don't... And so part of the function of mindfulness is to help us to see, to quiet the mind enough, to be in the present moment enough, that we can see how this is operating. What are we doing? What's going on? And in some ways, see the places of choice, where we have a choice to make a difference. How we can not add fire on fire. How we can quench the fire. How we can pull our hand out. Or how we can at least not add more fuel to the fire. And just kind of, you know, let it be. And so we learn to find those places of choice and begin choosing to act differently. And all of you have made a huge choice to come here and retreat. I think that was a choice. A couple of times I've been teaching retreat, and it wasn't exactly someone's choice they came on retreat. Well, I guess once it was this guy who, by all cultural, you know, outer appearance, did not seem like the kind of person who would show up on a retreat. And as I asked him, why are you here? Oh, it's a bet. Someone said I couldn't do it. So that's, you know. And another time, this woman came and I asked her, why are you here? And she said, I had an affair. And my husband found out. And this is the consequence. He brought me to the retreat. So, but I hope that all of you are here because you chose. And I've heard of people who stumbled on monasteries. I know one man who drove down a dirt road on his motorcycle, and the end of the dirt road was a Buddhist monastery. So he checked it out and didn't leave for years. So the choice, coming here is a choice. And I have a lot of respect for the choice that people make to come here, to this kind of thing. And I don't think it's easy. I think it's very important to work here. And I hope that we've set up the conditions and the teachers that we can meet you in a respectful way and support you in the choice you have to do this kind of practice, to show up and be present and to really explore this human condition in a deep way. And so we begin exploring and seeing. And the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering, can be understood to be, don't be afraid of your suffering. Don't be hesitant. Don't be unwilling. Don't feel like it's a mistake to suffer. There's all kind of extra attitudes we bring on top of us, our suffering. We have attitudes that something's wrong with me, I'm bad, I am, you know, someone else is to be blamed, this shouldn't be happening, I'm guilty, I'm, you know, whatever. We all these extra stuff. And one of the great gifts, I think, of this practice is if you're suffering, then the gift is suffer simply. Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. And part of the mindfulness practice is to learn to see clearly, begin seeing in the edges of your suffering and see, what are you doing that's extra? Are you resisting it? Are you fighting it? Are you making grand theories of the universe? Applying meaning to it? This means that, you know, whatever. And I know that's, you know, I see in my mind, I can make great conclusions, you know, kind of declarative statements about the existence of something by, I'm suffering and it's always going to be this way. My mind kind of, it's not just in my mind, it's something deeper, it's like a feeling, oh, this is it. My thinking mind is smart enough to know it's not going to be this way forever. But there's some kind of deep instinct inside that I sometimes, uh-oh, this is it. And I have that kind of delusion also with good states. I remember when I was one point when I was young, I was kind of spent a few months being kind of quite ecstatic. And I came to the conclusion, I'll never be depressed again. And that was in the summer. And that fall, I was more depressed than I've ever been in my life. Right after saying, I'll never be depressed. So, you know, these conclusions we make, and you know, they're so almost instinctual to make. So we can respect the instincts. It's not like your mistake that you make these pile suffering top of suffering. But it's possible to begin peeling it apart and become simpler with it and simpler with it. And oddly enough, it's possible to have a certain kind of joy with a radically simple suffering. It's just suffering. And part of that comes when we don't identify so strongly with it. That's part of the extra. It's me, my suffering. And some people don't want to give up their suffering because it's me and mine, I'm going to keep it. You know, this is important. And you know, this is how I negotiate my way in the world and get other people to see me through my suffering. And I better have it in the forefront so that people treat me just the way I want them. I want to get a lot of sympathy, so I have to be seen this way or something. But there's something very powerful about just learning how to be with suffering. And for some people, it takes a long time in this practice to learn to have simple suffering, just this. For some people, it takes a long time to learn how to have simple joy. I had a lot of resistance and a lot of judgments and ideas that joy and love and kind of the happiness and things like that had no role whatsoever in good Buddhist practice. I was trained in Zen, after all. And you're supposed to, and you know, I was in Japan, practicing in Japan, the monks would be tough. And they'd come and tell me, Gil, and they'd say in Japanese, Gil, you have to have Zen no chikara, which meant, Gil, have to have Zen power. So I thought you're supposed to go around grunting all the time. So, you know, it's okay. But sometimes that learning the simplicity of joy and holding that was a big learning for me, to learn to, it was okay to have joy, okay to have delight and happiness. And that was what the Buddha learned too. The Buddha was also lived in a culture where seemingly the renunciants, the people in the spiritual path back that time, there were some of them had a very, very strong distrust or negative view of anything to do that looked like pleasure or joy or things like that. And so there was a very strong ascetic streak in the religious times, religious practice in ancient India. And so it took a while for him to discover that there is an important form of joy to open up to. In fact, when he understood that there's kind of a joy from being settled and focused and really being present in the moment, that was when he began to find the path to freedom. He needed to discover that capacity to just be there with simple joy, and just being alive. So the nobility, the nobleness of suffering, please don't go looking for suffering. But don't avoid it when it arises. That's what this, that's what the call is here, you know. So sit here and be present for what is. The second noble truth is the noble truth of the cause. And the cause, you know, if you have your hand in the fire, it's very simple to see that. And so some things, as you get quieter, is kind of simple and obvious. That, you know, if you, you know, if they serve cookies at the meal here, and you're like, it's your favorite kind of cookie, and you're in the back of the line, and you start counting the people in front of you and counting how many cookies there are, and you spend the whole time in lines creeping up to the front, kind of watching the cookies and getting more and more anxious about, you know, it looks like they're disappearing. Is there some way you can get to the front of the line? Could you kind of step out of line and grab a few? But that wouldn't look so good. And so so you find yourself all caught up and getting all gnarly, getting a headache thinking about those cookies. And then you think about, you know, let's pay attention to what's going on to you, and you discover that the fire you have your hand in is the fire of craving. You don't need to have a cookie. You didn't even know you wanted a cookie. And, you know, 20 minutes before, you didn't even think about cookies. You were completely content. But there was a strong craving for a cookie. And you see it as a craving, and lo and behold, in that circumstance, it seems to be, it's easy, and you just let go of the craving, and the headache and the calculations disappear. That's kind of, hopefully, kind of matter of fact. So there's many things you can see that way that are pretty matter of fact. But the way that craving is said to be, strong desire, compulsive desire, is said to be the cause of suffering, it goes quite deep inside of us. And there's kind of very deep attitudes that we have that are almost kind of like more like impressions, or more like, it's more like moods that we have that are not often so obvious what's going on. So for me, like, I had this mood at some, certainly that, you know, when I was younger, that I was guilty. I didn't have to have a reason to be guilty. It wasn't like I had done anything. I was just plain old guilty. And I would go around, you know, or I'd do very ordinary things, like, I still remember very well, I would do things like opening a door, or in the meditation hall, I would walk across the meditation hall, and I was guilty. You just, you know, walking, opening a door. So I had a lot of it. Another one that was very deep for me was that, whatever was happening to me was not the real thing. What was real was always something better and mysterious that was different than what I was experiencing. But if it was happening to me, it didn't qualify. That I knew. And so it was always, the grass was always greener on the other side of the fence. But the fence was so high, I didn't even know what was on the other side. I didn't even know if there was grass over there. So, you know, it's kind of like just carried it with me. And it's like, and, you know, it was like a cloud that I didn't, you know, it was just like, you know, you, it's like sometimes my glasses get really dirty. They get dirty slowly over time, and I don't know they're dirty. It's just like this is how it is until someone comes and clean. My wife cleans them for me. It's like, oh. So so these clouds that we carry with us, we don't even see. So there is a few things that, you know, interesting, I think, exercises that it's possible to do. So get it to from a different angle, perhaps. So for you, the basic way that you, if you were going to characterize the basic way in which you carry yourself in the world, how you live in this world, how it is for you to be a person alive today, what, you know, the basic idea of how, the basic, you know, generic, usual way, what color would that be? If you had one color to choose to depict it, what color would that be? And what might that color tell you? Does it reveal anything to you? Is it a wonderful pastel, warm, cozy color, or is it black? Black can be nice. What color do you have? Or if you were going to had a pencil on a piece of paper, and you were going to draw lines on the paper that represented kind of your basic feeling of being a human being, what kind of lines would you draw? Beautiful swirls, jagged, arrows pointing at you, arrows pointing away. What would it be? What would it look like? And if any of these images kind of evoke something in you, does it maybe suggest something about yourself maybe you haven't seen before or really understood? We carry within us deep-seated images or attitudes about the world we live in, the world we kind of participate in, that's often very hard to see. You know, I remember there was times when I've carried with me a basic attitude of danger. And everything that I saw kind of had kind of vibes or had arrows or daggers or something. Everything was kind of like, you know, I couldn't get too close. It was kind of dangerous. It was kind of, the image was that of danger. The sense of it. And it's kind of very deep. Sometimes it's so deep you don't really see how it operates. Some years ago when my son was maybe 5 years old. We went to Yosemite and up by, I think it was Angel Waterfall or something. There was this beautiful lake. Beautiful, very peaceful, and there's no wind, beautiful sky, and it was so still and it was so pristine. And we were just sitting there on the edge of this lake, and it was so peaceful. And for me, an image of that I carry, kind of the image that I carry with me now, if I was going to evoke an image for how I feel it is like to be in the world, is that of a beautiful, clear, peaceful mountain lake. You know, like I'm looking out across the water, and it's so still, beautiful. So I was sitting on the edge of the lake with my son, and 5-year-old, and I said, look around, look at the lake. And then I suggested, close your eyes and see if you can visualize the lake without your eyes closed. So he did. I said, okay, now open your eyes and look around. So the image and the impression this lake gives, it's a really good one to kind of imprint and remember, and let it be there as kind of a memory you can call upon in the future and times of challenges. And, you know, it's a good thing to let it really take in here, this thing. Could you close your eyes again and visualize it? And he looked at me like I was crazy. What are you doing, Dad? Maybe I was doing it for my sake, not his. And so, you know, is there kind of an image for you, how, you know, of the world you live in? And is that image inherent in the world that you live in? And are there other images that you can take on? So this idea of the cause of suffering being craving, I think goes really deep into deep conditionings that we carry with us that have been formed by our life experiences, by our society, our family, by who knows what. And so as we sit and get quiet, and part of the advantage of being in retreat like this is that there's, compared to ordinary life, very few distractions that keeps us distracted from ourselves, that interrupts us from the continuity of seeing ourselves. And there's opportunities here to begin seeing ourselves in deeper and deeper ways. And start seeing some of the underlying attitudes, underlying pulls and pushes, the underlying things we're holding on to, the ways that we're caught, and begin questioning them. Put a question mark after them. And there's also a chance to begin meeting them with care and kindness, meeting them with a different attitude. And so the Brahmaviharas, to meet our suffering with kindness, metta, to meet it with a generosity of spirit, not to be for or against it, not to be hostile towards it or afraid of it, but to be friendly to our suffering. The causes of suffering, the craving and the clinging, the things that we're doing, how we put our hands in the fire, not to feel bad about ourselves or blame ourselves more, like, gee, this Buddhism is bad news, you know, suffering, and now they tell me I caused my suffering. And boy, I'm a loser now. But rather to see it as, to meet the causes within us, what we do, the psychological movements, that clinging of grasping of resistance and these things, compulsivity, and to meet it with compassion. Compassion is also a very generous thing to do. So are there images of love, loving kindness, compassion, that you can call upon, just like I tried to get my son to call upon, you know, this idea of a peaceful lake? Do you have images of kindness, of love, of compassion? Or are you going to look at me like I'm crazy? That you can call upon, you know, that can somehow, not to wash away the other deeper attitudes you have, but to meet them and hold them, care for them, be with them in a different way. So to meet these things with kindness, meet yourself with compassion. It's a beautiful thing to do this. And this compassion thing, you know, is coming together to one, the suffering, the causes, the path, all these things, and the Brahmaviharas, to bring them together. When we go and this respectful thing, you know, primary thing I think about when I bring my hands in namaste and bow, I think of respect and appreciation. Come together and have some respect for what is, to have some appreciation for what is. And also generally, people put their hands together in front of their hearts. And the Brahmaviharas are qualities of heart, many people would call it that. But heart is also the place of courage. And these things like compassion and loving kindness, I think one of the reasons I didn't like it when I was a Zen student, you know, I came to Vipassana from Zen, and they started doing this loving kindness thing. Who are these people? These artificial, saccharine, Hallmark Buddhism. You know, I wanted the real thing. The grunts. If you don't grunt enough, it can't be real. And so basically what I did when the Vipassana teacher started to do guided meditation and loving kindness, I did the most sensible thing I thought anybody should do. I just tuned them out. And it took me a while. What happened was that at some point, the very practice of mindfulness opened up to loving kindness. And I was kind of quite surprised. Wow, what's going on here? I felt all this kind of tremendous sense of goodwill, generosity of heart. And, this is what they're talking about. And then it wasn't any more an artificial thing. It came from the inside. And it became something very important for me. But one of the arguments I had about this was that it was kind of like, you know, kind of for weaklings. It's kind of like people who kind of needed a lot of, you know, acceptance, and, you know, it's kind of like kindergarten Buddhism and whatever. So, but I think now that we should really connect these things to courage. It takes a lot of courage to be able to meet our suffering with kindness. It takes a lot of courage to meet the causes of our suffering with compassion. I think compassion compassion matures is closely connected or entwined with courage. And we're asked to be very courageous in this practice. To sit here and really be still and to meet ourselves and face ourselves and be present for whatever is, and to keep doing it and keep doing it, keep showing up, not succumbing to some of the strong attitudes that might arise of despair or discouragement or anger or fear or conceit. I know it. I know how to do it better than everyone else. I know better. I remember sitting at the Zen Center and Zen monasteries, and sometimes we had to sit up. They had these optional sittings that were required. There were a lot of strange things in Zen, but they would call things different, like you anyway. So that was one of the optional sitting that was required, was late night sitting, and you had to show up for the late night sitting. That was optional, and then in Japan especially, but in Japan the rule was you can't leave that late night sitting until the people who are more senior than you have left. And we'd be sitting out on the balconies outside. I was there in November, and they had the Siberian winds blowing down from the Siberia, and we had these shaved heads sitting outside, and boy, was it cold. But we couldn't leave until the more senior people left. And so, you know, we would sit there and be stoic and sit there best we could, and slowly, slowly into the night, these more senior people would leave, and like I was the most junior one there. And there was a set of us, the most junior. And what was nice was when it was down to the last five of us, and all the more senior left, we would just then kind of finally give up and sit against the wall. We couldn't go right to bed right away. We had to wait, and we'd lean against the wall, and we'd take our big long sleeves and our robes, and we'd wrap it around our shaved heads to protect ourselves from the cold. And what the other Japanese monks wanted to talk about was baseball. But in America, we did the same thing, kind of. And there wasn't like, you didn't have to wait for the most senior one, but it was optional, right? And there was no end to the sitting. So it was optional when you went to bed. Well, optional about who was the last one to go to bed, or who stayed up, you know, who was had the real Zen power and the strength, and who would not, you know, who would sit up and not go to bed like a wimp. You know, so I remember sitting there next to other people, you know, and I kind of look side of my eyes like, why is he still there? He's not really sitting Zazen. He should go to bed. You know, I'm the one who's really sitting Zazen, but he's not sitting Zazen. You know, I wasn't sitting Zazen at all. I was just, I was caught up in this conceit and trying to be better than everyone else. Who knows what? So compassion for it all. And to have courage to admit it and to see our conceit is a great thing. And then to know the good news is that there's a cessation. And that's cessation, the freedom, the letting go, the cessation of craving, these causes. And to have a lot of equanimity not to hold that up another reason to be discouraged or to blame yourself. I can't do it. I can't let go. But to have a lot of equanimity And then when the letting go does happen, that brings a wonderful equanimity, delightful, happy equanimity. And then we have a path. And the path is very important. And we're very lucky to have a path of practice to walk. And a path that's integrated and includes all of our lives. And so we take a step, one step. We make the path each step we take. So rather than looking to the top of the mountain and thinking it's too hard to climb, the top of the mountain is just the next step. That's that mountain for that step, and then the next step. And just it's enough just to take, and we create the path as we walk. And so the path are things like, the end of the path is mindfulness, to be mindful of the situation and to be concentrated. And one of the advantages of practicing on retreat, where both mindfulness and concentration builds, is that the practices of mindfulness and concentration are truth tellers in our lives. You can't come on retreat without having to face the truth. And in daily life, it's easy to kind of somehow think things are different than the way they really are. We're kind of on the surface of our lives and surface of our beliefs and ideas and conceits and everything. And to come on retreat and really practice and begin getting settled and become still, to be focused, if there's a way in which it begins to highlight and reveal what's true for us. And some of that truth is not good news, but to meet that with kindness. Some of that truth is the best news you'll ever discover, and meet that with equanimity, with joy, with all this. But the ability to be still, present, and really focused to what's going on now, and to do it consistently, really give yourself over to it, will reveal to you the tremendous power of your heart that is held, represented by the Four Noble Truths and represented by the Four Brahmaviharas, the Four Divine Forms of Love that we'll talk about this retreat. So I'd like to end this talk by reading a story that I read that was published in a newsletter called the Inside Out e-newsletter. And Inside Out is a journal published by prisoners in San Quentin who have been trained in mindfulness and meditation, anger management, violence prevention, for all kinds of great things. And I go about once a year to meet these people, and some of these inmates in San Quentin who go through the mindfulness program there, they have this, maybe because it's so important in that kind of context what they're doing, they give themselves over to this practice so fully that I've seen some of the people there who are as transformed as anybody I've seen in doing this practice outside of prison. So they had these people who do this practice there. They have this newsletter, and one person wrote this. My night was like any other night. It was 8 p.m., time for close custody count. And then parenthesis, all prisons have institutional counts, wherein they count each prisoner's body to ensure no one is missing or has escaped. Not being there for count is considered a serious violation. The officer came to our cell and called my bunkie's name, after which my bunkie gave him the last two digits of his prison number. The same went for me. I did the same thing. Half an hour passed, and a neighbor comes to my cell and says they are paging me downstairs. I had not heard them calling for me. I went down to the podium, and the cops said to me, "Why were you not in your cell for count?" And I told them, "I was in my cell for count, as I have been every day and night for 12 years. And I have numerous neighbors that can verify that." It did not matter what I said. The cops told me to not do it again. And I am like, whatever. 2 days go by, and I find out that the sergeant gave me a write-up, a violation. I'm thinking, okay, I truly am not guilty of this, and I have many witnesses who say the same. However, at the hearing, the cop that counted me, did the count, said he looked into the cell 2 times and I was not there. It did not matter what I said or how many people I had who would say the same, because I was found guilty and given 40 hours of extra duty. I said to myself, screw this. I am not going to do the work. This is so unfair. I did nothing wrong, and these guys are wrong about this. I watched that count cop count me, and he did not look up from his count board once. His eyes never left that board. I filed a complaint against the officer. This is the last thing I wanted to do, but I was not wrong about this. They were. I felt bitter about being ordered to do these 40 hours of extra duty. In a phone call, I spoke to my mother about it, and she wondered if I could perhaps just take it, and regardless of the circumstance and the injustice of it, see if I could do what I would ultimately see if I could do what would ultimately be best for me. She said she would accept what I would decide, but if I could, please act respectfully. I reckoned if I refused to do the work, even though it came about unjustly, I would be guilty in their eyes. I chose to do the work anyway. I've always prided myself with doing exceptional work, and I was desperately looking to find my pride in this situation, somewhere, no matter what. So not only did I do the work, I did the best possible job I could do. I was asked to shine up this brass fire hydrant. Though I still felt resentful about those 40 hours of extra duty, I set off to shine up this hydrant, and I really got into the job. As a result, this hydrant started shining very brightly. As the sun caught it, I could see my face in it, and I noticed I was smiling from ear to ear. I began to laugh out loud for no reason other than enjoying that moment and seeing the result of my work. By putting all my conscious effort into shining up that fire hydrant, I had become bigger than the unfairness that led me to my assignment. I do not know how long I was at it, but when I was done, that hydrant, it looked like the prettiest thing in the whole prison, kind of like a small lighthouse standing proudly in an ocean of concrete, calling out how to steer on how to move through this place. I realized I was shining too, and it hasn't left me. Many people commented on that hydrant all week, wondering how come that thing gives off so much light all of a sudden. I just smiled. So maybe you have your hydrant this week, your fire hydrant, that maybe you can give yourself over to polish. Maybe you have your thing that you bring yourself mindfulness to. Just really bring yourself, be there. Be here with what is. Be here with what shows up. Give yourself over fully to the retreat, to the practice you do. Maybe this is your fire hydrant, your chance. By giving yourself over fully, you'll find the joy, the laughter, the delight of really giving yourself over to something. And maybe you'll shine while you're here. So, thank you. And it's the custom here at IMC, or most places, retreats, to spend a minute or two after a Dharma talk to kind of regather yourself into more of the contemplative mode, the meditative mode, so we can make a smooth transition to get back into the more practice mode while you're here. So thank you all very much for the day and for listening and for being here, and look for the sign up in a little while for the practice discussion, and for the new people to come here, be here at 7:15. Thank you.